Good afternoon. Nice to see you again. I've been asked to repeat the questions. When people ask questions, I'm very happy to do so. It's fair enough, since some people won't be able to hear the questioner. I just urge you, if you do hear the questioner, to compare carefully the actual question with my paraphrase of it. You've got to watch philosophers really closely when they repeat the question. Philosophers tend to do peculiar kind of tricksy things with questions, and we're often inspired by the example of a philosopher called Sidney Morgan Besser from Columbia University, a legendary figure who often was playful in response to questions. He was giving a public lecture once on the nature of the self, and it was all very sophisticated, and somebody towards the end put up their hand and said, "How do I know I exist?" And Morgan Besser sort of looked confused and leaned forward and said, "Sorry, who's asking?" Another thing I wanted to say beforehand is that you may have got the wrong idea about my position from the way I treated arguments to do with the relation between the mind and the body. Somebody came to me this morning and said, well, it was his impression that I favor the physicalist position over the dualist one. If this is your impression, I think it may just be because of the order in which I presented the arguments. I talked about dualism first because this famous argument for dualism is prior to famous arguments for physicalism. And then I offered an argument for physicalism, but remember what I said. I think they're both really powerful. I think part of the reason this is such a troublesome, difficult area of philosophy is that each position has something really profound and right-seeming to offer. And when I gave the physicalist argument, I didn't give it as a response to dualism. Note that my physicalist argument didn't respond to this powerful dualist point that consciousness doesn't seem to fit into a physical world. Conscious experience seems to be quite different in kind, it seems to be immediate, it seems to be accessed only privately. The arguments I gave for physicalism didn't respond to those directly, they simply gave deep points in favor of physicalism. I guess you might have been left with a different impression if I'd begun with the argument for physicalism and then said, but here's also an argument for dualism. But I have to begin with one. What I want to leave you with is the sense that there are profound arguments to be grappled with on both sides. I have no intention, indeed no capacity, of settling the arguments here. The arguments become really sophisticated on both sides. This is an introductory course of lectures. I'm simply offering them to you in an initial way as plausibly as I can. So whether physicalism or dualism is right has not been settled here, nor have I given an opinion on it. I should also mention that a few people have said, well, it's all very well having this discussion, but where are the answers? And it's a question I've had before. The first time I taught philosophy, somebody came up and said, yes, all very, very interesting. And this was at nearly the end of a semester-long course. But please, could you give us the answer book? Well, I wish I could. Unfortunately, the best way we have of getting to the answer is by thinking really carefully and arguing extensively and at length on these issues. This is not a course in mathematics. It's not as though I have the answer hidden away and I'm just perversely failing to give it to you. The best we can do is either be agnostic on these issues if we really don't know where the balance of reason is, or after careful long investigation, choose the answer which seems best to be supported. Okay. So that's the position on the mind-body argument. Which of them fails? The stakes are high. At least from what we've discussed, it's unclear. We talked quite a lot about a capacity for free choice yesterday, and I left us with a kind of cliffhanger, which was this. It seems that the world may be structured in a deterministic way. It may be that any event that happens has been determined by previous events. Naturally, the world is so very complex that it would require an extraordinary being to make precise predictions about what's going to happen next. But nonetheless, the suspicion is maybe the world is indeed structured this way, even if we can't make the predictions. As I say, the jury is out. some people say we'd have to wait for some final scientific theory, some final theory of physics before we decided on that, and for that we may be waiting a long time. But the worry is the world may be deterministic, and if our idea of free will is of a certain kind, then it seems to follow that we may not have free choice at all. If our idea of freely choosing is having if our idea is this, I have made a free choice if I have chosen one way, but I could have chosen other ways, then it seems that if determinism is true, then we don't have free choice at all. It's a worry. Some people have at the back of their minds this continual fear that perhaps they aren't free at all, despite the sense of freedom, despite the sense we have that we could go left or right. And I said, well, how, as students of philosophy, are we supposed to deal with this concern? One way is just to shrug and say, well, it's a worry. We feel like we have free choice, but maybe we don't. If determinism is true, then free choice is impossible. And this is the view of the incompatibilist, the person who says that determinism is incompatible with having free choices. But maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we misunderstood what it is to choose freely. Perhaps there is some analysis of free choice, a different one from the one I've just mentioned, which does allow for free choice even if determinism is true. An analysis which is not threatened by the possibility that the world might be deterministic. And what I left you with is the question, can we find such an analysis? It would need to be somewhat plausible. It would ideally concur with our intuitions about when we choose freely and when we don't. And it would need not to be threatened by the possibility that determinism is true. So here is the challenge. Find an analysis that has these features, including the fact that it conforms largely to the intuitive cases, to our intuition that when a gun is held to my head and somebody says, pick up the phone and call so-and-so, when I do so, I am not choosing to do so freely. And when I simply feel like calling a friend and I do so, I am choosing freely. Do we have an analysis of free choice which will allow us to make this distinction, which is not threatened by determinism? Yes?
If I'm faced with the two paths,
yes,
I can decide I'm going to throw a coin. I have absolutely free choice to decide I'm going to throw the coin. If it comes up heads, I'll go left. If it comes up tails, I'll go right. But I'm not going to just do it once, because the result of the coin being thrown may be determined by all the complicated factors you've said. I'm going to do it 50 or 100 times. And then I'm going to choose beforehand that on the 57th time, so I'll only do it 57 times, I will go what the 57th comes up, with a totally free choice to choose to go on the 57th one. The 57th one comes up heads, so I go left. I've made a perfectly free choice to go left because all the choices leading up to it were perfectly free. I can extend it further, but that's as far as I need go at the moment.
What a hiking companion you must be. All right, it's difficult to repeat the question, because it's to repeat the procedure, because it's a complex procedure. But it appears that the choice of going left or right is being outsourced to the coin. One flips the coin a number of times, as it were, as a warm-up, and one decides beforehand that on a certain flip one will go in the direction indicated by the coin. Now, the incompatibilist's worry is that if determinism is true, even a procedure like this one isn't one which involves free choice. Because the 57th flip, the result of that flip was just as predetermined as anything else which happens in this natural world. That's the incompatibilist's worry.
But was my choice of 57?
That's right, and the incompatibilist says that your choice of the 57th flip was also determined. So what we need to do, is find an analysis of what it is to choose freely which is not threatened by determinism. So if you or somebody else might be able to offer such an analysis, then we'll be away.
Craig?
Yes?
If you never look here to see what you say.
I'm sorry. From now on, I will look there often.
I've been wondering this since yesterday, so I'm not quite sure if this fits in with what you want answered right now, but I was wondering if one's frame of mind doesn't increase your capacity for free choice. For instance, I would think that an optimist would practice a far greater degree of free choice than a pessimist.
Well, this, I mean, it's an interesting idea that one's temperament might increase or decrease one's freedom. And I agree that it seems intuitive. So in an everyday sense, we would say, well, you know, the reason that person chose not to go up to that interesting new work colleague and have a chat was that they're crippled by anxiety. The reason this person easily makes friends, easily gets to know people, is that they have a very open temperament and personality, they're optimistic, they're sunny, and so on. All this seems intuitive. And I agree, it's an intuitive judgment. What the incompatibilist seeks to undermine is the sense that the optimistic, open, sunny person is any less freer in her choices than the pessimistic person. The incompatibilist says, look, if determinism is true, then we all choose unfreely at all times because all of our choices are determined. My temperament is determined, whether it's an open, sunny one or a rather closed, anxious one. So what we seek is an analysis of free choice which no longer regards the possibility of determinism as a threat. Now here is one such analysis, and note that this is potentially helpful to us. This sweeps away the original idea we had, that when I've chosen freely, it means that I had other options, and it replaces it with another notion of free choice. The idea is, perhaps we should do this, we should say, I've chosen freely when my choice has been determined by my own desires. There are different ways to put this, my own authentic desires, my own deep desires, rather than conflicting with them. Now, one benefit of this analysis is that it seems to conform quite well to at least some of our intuitions about when I have and haven't chosen freely. This analysis would say that the person with the gun to his head has not chosen freely to pick up the phone and make a call. It really isn't in full conformity to his own authentic desires. Yeah, it's in conformity with the desire not to be shot, sure. But there are other desires not to make the phone call with which his action does not conform, to which it doesn't conform. By contrast, according to this analysis, if I feel like calling my friend, I haven't spoken to her in a while, and I give her a ring, it is a free choice. That is because I haven't been coerced in any way. Nobody's holding a gun to my head. Nobody's given me some strange drug which causes me to act against my own authentic deep desires. And so I've chosen freely. My choice flows from my authentic desires. If you like an analysis like this, if you genuinely accept it, then it may well be that you will be become a compatibilist. That you will say, well, look, maybe everything that happens is indeed determined by what's gone before it. But nonetheless, there's an important difference between actions which are determined by my own desires and actions which are determined partially by external forces. Yeah, my own desires may be determined too, but the path to the choice really matters according to this analysis. If the path is via my own authentic desires, it's a free choice. If the path is partially by external compulsion, by being drugged, by being brainwashed, by any kind of force which acts against my own authentic desires, then I haven't chosen freely. It's a way to deflate the worry of determinism. It's a way of saying, look, so what if determinism is true? What matters is not whether the choice is determined. What matters is where the choice comes from, my own authentic desires or elsewhere.
Who is the determiner?
Well, in this case, the immediate determiner of picking up the phone is me. Comes from my desires. Anybody want to say anything in support of this analysis as opposed to the previous one? The one which made us scared? Yes?
I'm still scared and I need your help. If we take
I feel so proud to hear that. You know, as a philosopher, I'm not like an emergency surgeon or anything. You know, nobody calls me at 2 or 3 a.m. asking for, you know, help in metaphysics. So thank you. I'm here and I'm ready to help insofar as I can. I guess the catch is I can't help you, but I'm willing to listen.
If we take determinism to its logical conclusion, then even things which are called desires are caused and determined by the chemico-electrical function of my abstract incorporeal brain.
Now, it sounds like an insult. But,
no, it's intended to be very descriptive, normative.
Okay, good.
If we postulate extreme determinism, does the I exist still? Is there any I, as we are used to calling it?
Good. Now, the remark had a number of strands, but let me pick up two of them. The one was, and I'm going to have to paraphrase rather than repeat here. The one was, it's potentially short-sighted to say, even if determinism is true, I have chosen freely if the choice arises from my own desires. Because one then asks, from what do my own desires arise? They've been presumably determined by other desires of mine. And as we keep moving back, we find determinants outside myself. We find 10 or 100 or 1,000 years later, determinants of my desires at this moment, which are altogether different, which have nothing to do with me, which existed long before I did. Isn't this a worry? Doesn't this show that this analysis doesn't really deal with the concern? Well, maybe it does, and that's why some people have been worried about analysis like these and haven't thought that they take away our fear. This analysis simply says, if determinism is true, but the chain of causation of determining events goes through me via my authentic desires, then I've chosen freely. And maybe you don't like that. Maybe you're worried about that chain and how far back it goes. How it goes back to before I existed, and you think, well, it's not really a free choice if it's ultimately determined by things, factors that existed long before I did. Still, maybe you're convinced by the notion that as long as the chain of determination goes through my desires, I've chosen free. That's one strand. The other strand was, if determinism is true, if everything that happens is predetermined, then can it really be that there's an I? Can I be here at all? Well, maybe they... I'm not sure why a being wouldn't exist just because its existence has been determined. Is this like one of those programs where you can choose to call a friend to get a philosophical answer? So I may bring something into existence. If we think of a little clay object, right? Its existence may be determined by my actions, but that doesn't show that the clay thing doesn't exist. It just shows its existence has been determined. Similarly, my existence may have been determined by what comes before me, but that doesn't cast doubt on my own existence, surely. One might just say, well, I exist because of what came before me. So that is one response. Are there any other remarks from this part of the room? Okay. Because I'm only concerned about you at this stage.
Can I just make a comment?
Yes.
I don't think a desire is necessarily pure and unadulterated. Your desire can be influenced, for instance, by guilt. I haven't felt this person for ages.
Yes.
Therefore, I must go there now.
Yes. Well, the point of this analysis is, as long as it's... Sorry, the question was, surely your own desires could be influenced by other feelings you have, such as guilt. Well, somebody who offered this analysis would say, look, do we regard the guilt as authentically mine? I mean, assuming we do, then there's no problem saying it's my free choice.
No, the guilt is put on us by society.
Well, I guess, I mean, there are, of course, many, many grey areas here, and that's to be expected. But you might think about the source of the guilt, right? If I've undergone a little session of brainwashing beforehand, where somebody emphasizes the important role that guilt should play in my life, right? And I find this person very persuasive, and they use all kinds of techniques that aren't rational but are nonetheless persuasive, then it might be very well true, according to this analysis, that I haven't really made a free choice to phone my friend. Because this analysis might say, well, the guilt that's influencing me doesn't really count as my own authentic guilt. Maybe it's been imposed by brainwashing. If, on the other hand, I'm a reflective, thoughtful person and I wake up feeling guilty and I make the call on that basis, the analysis would say, it's my own guilt. It's authentic. Now, these are grey areas, right? And they're philosophically fascinating to try and work out an analysis which appropriately distinguishes free from unfree choices. But there's a more basic point about this kind of analysis, which is, if you like it, if you accept it, if you are, in other words, a compatibilist, then the worry about determinism disappears. Even if the world is deterministic, some of your choices are still free because of the deterministic route they travel through your own desires rather than through external influences which, as it were, impose choices on you independent of your own authentic feelings.
So what's the difference between brainwashing and your own desires, then?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, one I don't plan to deal with today.
Then a cop out.
If I were to respond to all philosophical questions that arose from my philosophical treatment of these great fundamental questions, we would be here not only all day, but possibly eternally. So I prefer to see it not so much as a cop-out, but a well-organized little piece of philosophy. Okay. So as I said, on this view, this alternative analysis, free choices aren't necessarily undetermined. The point is that they're choices that are determined, but they're determined by our own desires. And determinism's no threat to freedom, but in fact, in a sense, required for freedom. Determinism, at least in the sense that my desires determine my choice. As long as my desires are determining my choice, I'm free. No matter where those desires themselves came from, even if we could follow a causal chain back 10 million years, I'm still free as long as the choice came via my desire. Now, there's actually much more to say, but I want to move on. I want to move on to the first of our two ethical questions in these talks. And I pose this question slightly differently to the way I did in the course outline. The question is, how do we decide the right thing to do? It's a profound question. It's one we become aware of first as children, and I think that the question struck me strongly when I came upon a print. How many people have actually seen this print? It's called, De Brede Weg en de Smalle Weg, right? The broad path and the narrow path. It's a very famous 19th century Dutch print with a religious orientation, and it's been very, perhaps not as popular as it used to be, but it used to be found in a great many homes. I came upon this print as a child, and I was intrigued by this metaphorical representation of two ways to live. You've got the broad path. I mean, as soon as you know it's broad, it's bad. And then you've got the narrow path. The broad path is sinful, and the narrow path is the path of righteousness. Now, I remember as a child looking at this and being greatly struck by it. It is a remarkable print in many ways. I mean, not only does it express various religious doctrines, particularly those of certain strands of religion in the mid-19th century, but it's also, I think, quite beautiful, and it has all kinds of aesthetic interest. Anyway, I remember looking at this print and thinking, well, you know, the activities, you can't see them so clearly, the activities on the broad path are of varying kinds. Some of them are indeed presumably bad. We have somebody beating an animal here, and I thought, well, that's surely a bad thing. Some of them I wasn't so sure about. So attending the theatre, for example, which also takes place on the broad path, or buying a lottery ticket, or, and this is very close to damnation, taking the train on Sundays, didn't seem to me clearly to be bad things. And I wondered at the time, what was the best determinant of the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do. Now, I want to talk today about a famous answer to that question. We're entering the realm of ethics, and it's an absolutely gigantic area of philosophy, and I certainly shan't give you an overview, because I think that would be a little tedious, a little dreary. Instead, I'm going to give you an introduction to a famous strand of ethics called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism became most prominent in the 18th and 19th century. Here are two famous utilitarians. That's John Stuart Mill on the left, one of my very favorite philosophers who writes beautifully and has many deep things to say on a variety of topics. And who was not only a deep thinker, but a really brave thinker and fighter for all kinds of good policies, for the emancipation of women, for example. The person on the right is the 18th and 19th century philosopher Jeremy Bentham. That's a photo. And actually, that really is Jeremy Bentham. He was a founder of University College London, and according to the terms of his will, his body was preserved after his death and can still be found in a cabinet in UCL. So that is Jeremy Bentham himself. I seem to remember he presides over meetings of the College Council, of University College Council still. There he is. These two famous utilitarians, as well as many others, had, I think, a disarmingly simple approach to what counts as good and what counts as bad. Now, there are a tremendous variety of approaches. You'll recall that post I put up earlier, that remarkably stimulating one, De Brede Weg en De Smalle Weg, which takes a particular strand of religious orientation to deciding what is good and what is bad. The utilitarian said this: if you want to decide the right thing to do, here's what you do. You identify what's good or valuable. Call it X for now. We'll get to what X is. And you act in a way that maximizes this good or valuable thing. So whatever is good or valuable, you act in a way which maximizes it. Presumably you have some options. Let's set aside the free will problem. And you choose the option that maximizes X, the good, valuable thing. That's the good and right thing to do. Sometimes you might not reach that option, but you want to get as close as possible to it. Now, what is that X? What's the good, valuable thing? The traditional, the old utilitarian answer was that what's good is, well, narrowly put, pleasure, but more broadly put, happiness. It seems disarmingly simple. The right thing to do at any given stage is whatever maximizes happiness. It was a popular 19th century position. Now, I want to mention some merits of utilitarianism. Of course, we'll go into concerns about it, but let's begin with some merits. As philosophers and students of philosophy, part of the philosophical temperament, I think, sometimes involves trying to find holes in a doctrine as soon as we hear about it. I think that would be a mistake. I think what we ought to do is try and see the best in the doctrine, try and put it in the best possible light before we think of criticisms, just to make sure that we're not missing any of the merits, just to make sure that insofar as we criticize the doctrine, we're seeing it in the best way we can. Now, I think one kind of merit of utilitarianism is its apparent simplicity. What do you do? What should you do? You should act in a way as to maximize happiness. Secondly, it seems to be an unmysterious doctrine about what the right thing to do is. Let's offer a comparison. Suppose somebody spends a number of years in quiet reflection, right? Almost in an ideally a mystical state, who sits, who leads a simple life, and who emerges and says, the following principles of morality have come to me. And then offers a list. And he says, well, this is the right way to behave. I've been in deep reflection all these years, and here are the answers. This is what we ought to do. Well, it would seem fair to say, what is the source of your inspiration, and can we find the source trustworthy? You know, the person might say, the source of my inspiration is God, or the source of my inspiration is somehow the universe itself, or some kind of more hazy origin, but there's something a little mysterious about that. We want a robust, trustworthy sort of doctrine, ideally, one which everybody might be able to accept, at least so this thought might go. And so utilitarianism takes away the mystery, because the thought is, well, I mean, who is against happiness? Surely happiness is a good, valuable thing, and we want to maximize it. Let's hold the criticisms until we've finished with the merits. Finally, utilitarianism seems on the face of it a very broadly acceptable doctrine. So we might hold moral views, for instance, related to our religious commitments. So you might say, well, look, I think the right thing to do is so-and-so because I found it in the New Testament, or I found it in the Torah, or the Quran, or the Bhagavad Gita, or all kinds of other texts. And certainly many people in all of these cases are going to agree with us, but there'll be large constituencies who say, I don't really recognize the authority of this work. A utilitarian might say that utilitarianism takes away that problem, because what at least a great many of us have in common is the fact that we value happiness. We regard happiness as a good thing. Now, I'm about to come to the concerns, but I'm interested to hear any concerns you may have. We had, somebody said for whom? Did you say for whom? Yes?
My happiness might not be his happiness.
No. I don't want you to, you know, get in the way of anything that might be happening. Yes. So the idea was my happiness might not be his happiness, and presumably one of the things you might mean is that a thing that makes one person happy is very different from what makes another person happy. And the utilitarian would presumably need to take that into account. If the utilitarian says we should do whatever maximizes happiness, and if, as you point out, different kinds of things maximize happiness for different people, that just makes being a utilitarian somewhat more complex. What you'd need to figure in your calculations about what to do is, what will help people to thrive? What will help people to be happy? People are, of course, different from one another. So what if I'm dealing with one group, a certain action in relation to them may maximize their happiness, but that action would be entirely inappropriate for another little group of people who are quite different in their temperaments and their needs and interests, who would be far happier if I did something else. I think that's a valuable point for the utilitarianism, for the utilitarian, which the utilitarian wouldn't count as a criticism, but simply a point about what he or she would need to look at when thinking about how to maximize happiness. Anything else? Yes, I'll get to you.
I kind of feel that most make you happy if you don't do those things. I mean, the test of pleasure is not doing something which is dictated by who you are. It's not positive, as I mean. It's a negative. You're happy if you can make the cross so that none of these bad things.
Okay. Now, the point here is, it's a remark. The idea is that you're happy if you don't do bad things. Well, let's think about this. We could see this as a helpful point for the utilitarian. The utilitarian is going to think, what makes people happy? And one of the points for the utilitarian is, it differs according to different people, sure. The utilitarian might then say, what do many of us have in common? And the point here is, well, perhaps what many of us have in common is that we don't feel happy when we're doing bad things. Two remarks about that. Firstly, I fear that some people really enjoy doing bad things. And I fear that when I read Plato, as you rightly point out, Plato says that it's only by being good that we can be happy, and, you know, evil people don't lead happy lives. But it seems to me that some evil people have a really good time, at least until they're caught, and some aren't caught at all. But secondly, I worry that there might be a kind of circularity in that remark as advice to the utilitarian. The utilitarian says, what is it to act in a way that's good? Well, acting in a way that's good involves maximizing happiness. And the piece of advice here is, what is it to maximize happiness? Well, it's to encourage people to act in a way that's not bad. Now, it seems that there might be some circularity here, because if you conjoin the initial and the final point, you get acting in a way that's good involves acting and encouraging people to act in a way that's not bad. So that might not ultimately be so helpful, because we're looking for an analysis of good and bad acting which doesn't actually employ those terms, which isn't circular. Yes? Sorry. Yes?
Does it not have to go, happiness implies to me that you're self, you know, you're self-centered. Is there not something here that's got to be, it's good for those around me?
Well, it's a nice point. I mean, I might say, well, you could become happy by helping other people. Just because it's your happiness doesn't mean that it's somehow selfish. Your happiness might be achieved by helping other people, but perhaps you might say that the ultimate goal, what's really good, is not my own happiness. It's increasing the well-being of people in general, something like that. Well, the utilitarian might say, the idea is not to maximize your happiness, the idea is to maximize happiness. It's a good point, because it enables me to be more precise about the doctrine. The doctrine doesn't say, the right thing to do is that which maximizes my own happiness. The right thing to do is that which maximizes happiness. The utilitarian doesn't give me a special privilege, and in fact, that is going to be a foundation for one criticism which is sometimes offered of the utilitarian. Let's have one last point for the time being. Yes?
Yeah, the problem of torture. If you know that there's a time bomb hidden somewhere, you know who's hidden it there, that time bomb is going to kill hundreds of people. You torture that person to stop that time bomb going off. You make a lot of people happy. You make one person very unhappy. That's one point. The other point is this term maximize. Suppose you are the last person left alive on Earth. Does utilitarianism still operate?
I guess, well, to take the second point first, the second point was, suppose you're the last person left on Earth, does utilitarianism still operate? I think it actually operates in a remarkably simple way. To be a utilitarian then becomes just to maximize your own happiness, because you're the only one left. As for the ticking time bomb example, I think you're getting at something important when you think about what utilitarianism licenses. But the point was this. The idea was, perhaps there's a ticking time bomb. It's going to be able to kill hundreds of people if it goes off. Utilitarianism would find it perfectly acceptable to torture one person, causing them untold misery in order to prevent death to everybody else. Isn't that a problem for utilitarianism? Well, actually, I'm not sure it is a problem for utilitarianism. I think if we... because I think, at least for many of us, our intuitions go a little shaky here. We think, well, if there really are these hundreds of people who are going to be dead unless we torture, maybe torture is the better out of two dreadful options. So, while I think utilitarianism does have problems with what you can do to an individual for the benefit of a group, I'm not sure that option really sharply offers a criticism of utilitarianism, because I'm not sure we say utilitarianism delivers the obviously wrong answer. Let me turn to some criticisms which have often been made. And one concern is that the attitude of the utilitarian towards individuals is just inappropriate. We'll see why that might be. And another is that utilitarians make a mistaken identification. This is a really fundamental criticism. A mistaken identification of goodness with happiness. Goodness should not be equated with happiness. Let's see how these criticisms work. So here's the inappropriate attitude kind of criticism. Some people say, well, one way in which utilitarians have inappropriate attitudes to individuals is that they require an immense amount from any individual. I'm sitting down with my family, at the dinner table, and we have this lovely spread in front of us, right? Perhaps it's a special occasion, it's somebody's birthday, we've pulled out all the stops, everybody is really happy. Well, is it going to maximize happiness to choose to do this? If one is really an honest utilitarian, it seems one has to come to the conclusion that a desire to maximize happiness is inconsistent with having this lovely spread for a birthday dinner. That if you want to maximize happiness with the X amount of rand you were to spend on that, what you ought to do is take that money and spend it on some of the many millions of people who exist in misery. You can greatly increase their happiness with that amount of money. You could perhaps increase significantly the happiness of many people with the amount you're going to spend on that special occasion. Perhaps it's a once a year occasion, right? It's a lovely birthday. Don't have the birthday party and spend quite a bit on it. Don't have that at all. Pass the money over to the poor. Now, what some people say is, it is entirely appropriate to say that we're morally obliged to give something of what we have to those who have nothing. But the utilitarian asks too much. If you think about it, a great many of your actions, at least on this traditional utilitarian view, would become inappropriate, would become wrong actions. Anything that you do, in fact, just above a kind of subsistence level, seems not to be maximizing happiness. It seems that an enormous amount of surplus beyond subsistence needs to go to those who need it desperately. So one kind of criticism is that the utilitarian is just too demanding. And I'll have something to say about what the utilitarian can say in response. Another way in which utilitarians are sometimes said to have an inappropriate attitude to individuals is this. If you're just interested in maximizing happiness, it opens the possibility, and I'm going to give an example like the one the questioner gave earlier, but attempting to more sharply put a problem for utilitarianism. It opens the possibility of terribly oppressing one person for the sake of everybody else. One person who intuitively, we might say, hasn't really done anything wrong. There's a community of people who all hold similar views, let's say political views, religious views, and there's one dissenter. The dissenter enrages everybody. They're not used to dissent. The very fact that this person makes her views public is deeply offensive to them. Her political views, her religious views, her views of any other kind. They want to get rid of her. Their days are marred by her presence, by her advocation of her views. What is the utilitarian going to say? Well, if we imprison her, if we shut her up in some way, it will make her deeply unhappy. But it will far be made up for by the joy of the crowds who no longer have to deal with her dissent. It does seem to be a worry about utilitarianism, and at least many of us would say, even if, at least for a while, the happiness of the entire community is decreased by the one dissenter, it is wrong to silence her. Let me mention, because I want to just move a little bit further today, this final kind of response, a kind of fundamental reply to the utilitarian, which says, it's just wrong to identify goodness with happiness. You could have happiness without goodness and goodness without happiness. And let's give a kind of example of each. That's Hendrik Verwoerd, as you may recall, on the left. And some people might say, look, the happiness of Hendrik Verwoerd and other architects and maintainers of apartheid, their happiness in performing their roles, even if it is great, does not count in favor of the morality of what they're doing, does not count in favor of the goodness of what they're doing. No matter how happy the architects of apartheid are at the passing of some new legislation, no matter how unrestrained their joy, that doesn't contribute towards any goodness of that activity. That activity is bad, and it remains just as bad no matter how glad they are. In other words, we can have happiness in the complete absence of goodness, as much happiness as we like. The second kind of criticism says, what about goodness in the absence of happiness? So there are all kinds of poignant examples we can think of. Suppose that I have a a life partner and my life partner suffers some terrible illness, is barely conscious after that, and I spend some years caring for my partner. Now, I devote myself to it fully, and these are years where there is very little happiness, let us suppose. My partner is not in a state where he or she can appreciate the attention, but nonetheless, I devote myself to this person. Are these years of happiness? No. Have I behaved well? Have I behaved nobly? Is this good behavior? Intuitively, I think many of us want to say yes, absolutely. We have a separation of goodness and happiness, and according to these criticisms, utilitarianism must fail. Would anybody like to offer any remarks either further against utilitarianism or in favor of the utilitarian? Yes.
Oppressed minority here.
Yes, no longer.
It seemed to me it's easier to deal with it when they're extremes, one person against the many. But it becomes more and more complex as you get towards the 50% mark, if you like. And that you may get 50% plus one dominating the now minority, which is just failing by one. So you get it in politics, but you'll get it in morality too, where the 50 plus one are now making decisions, supposedly for the general good, but it's only marginally for the general good, if you like. And I suppose apartheid may have been an example of that at one stage. And that, you know, we're doing this for the best of everybody. You know, that was the apparent conviction.
Now, okay, thank you. Let's see if I can take some of those points. One of the points is, what happens if there's just a slight majority of people on a particular issue? The utilitarian is going to say, given the choice of pleasing, if our only choices are pleasing the 51% or pleasing the 49%, if that's all there is, there are just two policies available, we should please the 51%. And you think, well, there's something distressing about that, because what about the poor 49ers? I mean, the other point about apartheid potentially being an example of that is a point that I think would require work, because as far as I understand, whites were never the majority in this country. But let's think about that first point. Well, I suppose the question to ask is, if there really are only two policies available, one to suit the 51, one to suit the 49, and there's no kind of compromise policy which suits everybody in some better way, then how can you do any better than the utilitarian would? What are you offering as another option?
Compromise.
That's a different policy. The way the person who offered this remark set it up was that somehow circumstances are such that there are only two policies. If there is a compromise policy which will offer a net increase of utility, of happiness, then you, but also the utilitarian, are going to choose that policy. Maybe utilitarianism's not so bad in this respect. Any other thoughts? Yes, at the back.
If one were able to calculate this happiness index into the future, might it be possible to argue that in the long term, the happiness and goodness aspect might be reconcilable?
Good.
In the short term.
Good. This remark says, well, the way I'm choosing to construe it, says at least some of these criticisms of utilitarianism gain their force by looking only at short-term considerations. The utilitarian might say, for instance, sure, you'll please the mob for the next day or two if you burn out the character who is the dissenter. But in the long run, you will not maximize utility by doing so. In the long run, there is value in keeping the dissenter around, and ultimately it will increase everybody's happiness. Now, that may well be true, and it may well be true for reasons I'll talk about tomorrow, because I want to talk about a really wonderful, inspiring view of John Stuart Mill's on freedom of speech, and that's an approach the utilitarian might take. So as a utilitarian, one might say, these criticisms focus only on the short term. In the long-term vision, utility, happiness is really what we ought to value, and utility takes us towards, for instance, a respecting of individuals who hold particular political or philosophical or religious views. I think that is certainly an approach worth exploring for the utilitarian. Further thoughts and questions? Yes.
I think utilitarianism is in many cases impractical for the following reason. The gentleman over there mentioned the 51-49 dichotomy. What one really needs to do to make that decision, ignoring compromise, is to weigh the two amounts of goodness which will result. One can consider a situation where the 49%, who are a minority, have such great benefits that they overwhelm the 51. And to weigh the relative amounts of goodness is what I consider impractical. And that reflects too on the last point.
A very nice point. The idea is that we ought not merely to, well, one way to put it is that we should not merely take into account a person's preferences by saying, do you want X or Y? Or do you say yes or no to this question? We also ought to measure the intensity of somebody's desire, the intensity of the happiness they will get by the enacting of some or other policy. And the utilitarian certainly needs to accept this, because to maximize happiness is not just the same as maximizing the agreement of a number of people who say yes or no. We need to take intensity into account. Now, some people are skeptical about how practical it is to take intensity into account. And I am convinced, as I'm sure you are, that an absolutely precise measurement of intensity of a desire is impossible. But surely, intuitively, we can get a sense of how much some group of people really want something. We can get a sense from their behavior, from the amount, from the extent to which they're agitating for that thing, from the circumstances of their lives. I think a precise measurement is impossible, but the utilitarian doesn't ask for the impossible. The utilitarian asks us to come as close as we can to maximizing happiness. Aristotle says somewhere, something I like to say a lot, I mean, not that much, but I like to say it occasionally, now and then, which is that we shouldn't try to be more precise than our subject matter allows. So if you are a utilitarian and you want to maximize happiness, and you come to the view that you cannot do so in any precise way, then you shouldn't try and flog the dead horse and say, well, give me a precise quantity of happiness which a person will get from a certain policy. You just say, give me a ballpark figure. Let's get a sense. And often we can get a sense. We can get a sense of the difference between a person who says, yeah, that would be kind of nice, but I'm not that invested in it, and somebody who is passionately for a particular policy. And maybe the utilitarian can bring those admittedly imprecise, but nonetheless existent, broad differences of intensity. Maybe the utilitarian can use those differences in making the calculation. Anybody else? Just a sec. Let's have, you know what I would like? Sorry, I don't mean to stop you, but I'm aware some people have spoken and some people have not. Is there anybody who has not yet spoken who might wish to offer a remark? Yes.
You go one screen, one side forward again, please.
Sure. This one?
Yes.
For Wood's eyes are mesmerizing, I must admit. It's,
I
yeah.
agree.
Yeah.
Goodness is better than happiness, one would think intuitively. We've gone a little bit circular, because in the beginning the question was, how do we know what is right? And what is right, I suggest, is what is good. And we've got the...
I was going to say good, but I don't want to add to the confusion there.
say right.
Well, let me... What was I doing with this point? Here's what I would be doing if I were doing the kind of thing you're worried I'm doing. Okay? Here would be a bad thing to do. A bad thing to do would be to say, right, we want to understand what goodness is. Here's a criticism. There's an analysis of goodness which says that it really amounts to happiness. The good or right action amounts to one which maximizes happiness. But that analysis is not correct. I'm offering you an alternative analysis of goodness, and my analysis of goodness is goodness. That would clearly be circular. That's no analysis. That just amounts to repeating myself. What I'm doing here is something different. I am bringing to bear some cases which I'm hoping you will agree with in order to undermine the analysis of goodness as happiness. And I undermine it by saying that the two can be divorced. You can have happiness without goodness and goodness without happiness. I am not offering an alternative analysis. My task in this slide was purely a negative one of undermining the happiness analysis. Anybody else who might not have spoken yet? Or anybody who has not spoken today? Different matter. Yes?
I think often doing good tends to make you feel good. And that is a kind of happiness. And also there is the danger of a small fanatical minority overwhelming a large group of people who would have better will towards people. But you have the danger of fanatics taking over power and putting their happiness before other people.
Okay, thank you. Now this is the last question I'm taking, and there are two strands. I'll take the second one first. The second one is a nice point about the overwhelming, the possibilities of a small fanatical group overwhelming a large group with milder preferences. Now if you are a utilitarian, then presumably, as I said earlier, you're going to try and take intensity into account. You want to maximize happiness. So it may be that if a group is sufficiently fanatical, if its desires are just enormously strong, then that group, for a utilitarian, is going to exercise what we think may be disproportional influence on policy. Because pleasing the fanatics will generate tremendous amounts of happiness. And maybe we think there's a problem with that, that just because people are capable of being enormously pleased by satisfying their desires doesn't mean they should matter enormously more than other people. As for the first point, it was a thought about being good, and you said that being good often makes you feel good. Well, one way of construing that point is as a variety of the happiness analysis. So perhaps happy is a term that's not quite broad enough. You want a fulfilled, satisfied, self-actualized, some kind of deeply satisfying mental state that being good puts you into. And I guess that would be one way of construing that point, would be to urge the utilitarian to find some term or find some cluster of terms to identify a family of things that being good can amount to. Maximizing happiness, maximizing satisfaction, maximizing all sorts of other things. Now, I want tomorrow to say a little bit more about why utilitarianism could be a problem. And in fact, this point is really helpful because a point I'm going to make earlier tomorrow is that it seems wrong to some people to identify goodness with any mental state whatsoever. Happiness or anything else, goodness isn't the same as those. So utilitarianism is just absolutely fundamentally incorrect on that view. And then we'll offer some responses utilitarians can have. And then we'll have what I've saved for last, what I think is a marvelously inspiring philosophical view by John Stuart Mill. I'll see you then.